Welcome to the iCoder Podcast with Ian McDuff.
Hello once again, podcast and ODR audience, and welcome to this iCoder Podcast. I'm Ian McDuff, and I'm your host for the series, and I'm speaking with you, as usual, from Wellington in Aotearoa, New Zealand. In this conversation, I'm delighted to be joined by my friend and colleague in the global ODR network, and very much a pioneer in the ODR network, Professor Ben Davis. Emeritus Professor of Law, Ben Davis was a faculty member from 2003 at Toledo. Was a full professor from 2015, again at Toledo College of Law, and retired from that position in 2021, although I gathered in our previous conversation, not entirely retired. I have to have a conversation with you, Ben, about how to go about retiring.
Yes.
Maybe that's another conversation for a number of us to have. Ben has taught at a number of universities, including Toledo and University of Illinois Chicago and Washington and Lee. But prior to joining Toledo, Ben was associate professor at the Texas Wesleyan University School of Law, which is now Texas A&M. And I think you were at Texas A&M when we first met through the ODR competition.
Yes, exactly. Yep.
And between 1983 and 86, Ben worked in Paris, France, that is, as a development consultant for West Africa and as a strategic business consultant with Marsden & Company in Europe. In 1986, he became American legal counsel at the International Court of Arbitration of the International Court Chamber of Commerce in Paris. Ben, as I said, is a pioneer in this field and was the creator of Fast Track International Commercial Arbitration in 1991. And the creator of the International Competitions for Online Dispute Resolution between 2000 and 2005, but through which our students from around the world were able to compete in online negotiation, mediation, arbitration, litigation. Great competition, a lot of fun. Ben is past chair of the ABA section on dispute resolution and recipient of their D'Alembert Raven Award. Ben is a retired member of the New York Bar and the Supreme Court of the US Bar. Of special note, recently, Ben was appointed as the Chevalier Ordre des Palmes Académiques of the Republic of France, which is a pretty high accolade, young Ben. Ben, welcome to the podcast series. Great to see you. Thank you for taking the time to talk with us.
Ian, it is a pleasure to see you. We've had this virtual relationship, I think, except in Paris, when we finally got to meet each other in Paris. Yep. But going back now, I guess 23 years, which is kind of amazing. I remember you as being one of the first professors who was game to play in the International Competition of Online Dispute Resolution to get your students involved back in 2000, 2001, and really helped spread this idea of having students from around the world be able to compete from their computers, you know, without having to do all the travel and all the costs and all that and do it for free. So it's always been a good thing to watch what you do over the years in moving forward dispute resolution and in all the areas you worked in. So I'm really happy to be there. Hello, everybody out there. It's always a pleasure to talk about things with people. I hope what we talk about is of interest. So
it's bound to be. Ben, pick up a number of threads from our various conversations and from your work. I was just going back over some of the correspondence you and I have had and your contributions to our ODR network conversations on digital justice, AI, ethics. And it seems to me that the special brief you have that you've given yourself is to be concerned about the interface between humans and technology. And it's a very powerful, ethically based brief. And one of the things I want to come back to later is your concern about equity issues, because I think that's a clear issue, not just in the ODR field, but generally. But one of the terms you've used in recent correspondence is tricknology. And it tells me that you're not always a technology optimist.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I wish I coined that term, but actually, I heard it for the first time, maybe 5 or 6 years ago with one of the there were these 5 young men who were convicted of a horrible crime in Central Park in New York called the Central Park 5, and ultimately they were exonerated from it, and it turned that there'd been a rush to judgment, and one of them went on to get a PhD, and he came to speak at Toledo at one point in time as a guest speaker at an event. And somebody was talking, asking him a question about technology, and he said, "Oh yes, tricknology." And I said, "Ah, fascinating, tricknology, interesting." And just as a concept, where you know, there is this kind of excitement we all have when the new thing. Right now, I think new thing we're hearing a lot about is ChatGPT. Right, that's the new thing right now, but 30 years ago, it would have been Windows coming in after MS-DOS or something like that, or the Apple, you know, whatever it was, the Macintosh or whatever. That was the new thing. And in dispute resolution, there was the Uniform Domain Name Dispute Resolution System that the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers came up with in the late 90s, early 2000s, called UDRP. Again, yep. There are always these new things that come along, and you know, part of it is the marketing of them. We understand that, but you know, there's always this sort of a gee whiz, wow, isn't this great stuff? Facial recognition technology is a thing that you hear now. There's a lot of people talking about AI, right? Right now, that's another thing that people talk about: AI, mm-hmm. which
we cry for help.
You know, yeah. Well, one of the funny things about, you know, for me at least, was as a way to maybe keep in a really simplified way, in a way that I think people will get easily, is this incredible tragedy we just saw with these gentlemen in the Ocean Gate submersible, mm-hmm. right? Going down and all that happened with them. Terribly horrible experience. And you know, what is the Ocean Gate ship was a technology. It was a technology, submersible technology, mm-hmm. that was designed in a certain way. You know, there were sort of industry standards apparently said about 2 or 3 years ago, industry group saying things like, watch out, this is, you know, there's problems with you. I think it's carbon fiber technology, yep. was one of the technologies being used in it.
And which titanium.
Is, you know, and titanium. And, you know, and this was sort of the theory of the technology was that this would be a sort of better way of doing this. You know, and lo and behold, I just read a thing yesterday that one of the people who passed away, who actually went to my high school after me, so one of the people who passed away, the head of the company, had bragged about getting some sort of old carbon fiber from Boeing and putting it in the ship, you know? And so maybe the carbon fiber theory was something that was interesting, but sort of end of life carbon fiber being in a boat for something going down to the bottom of the ocean is kind of a trick in a way to me. It looks like it's the theory of the technology might have been something that maybe could be argued, although some people question even that. But then all finding out that the actual carbon fiber is not what I'd call right off the shelf brand new, but is kind of old stuff. It's like my 10-year-old car stuff, you know, you're running enormous risks. And in a way, that is the, you know, a way of showing an image of something where you're, gee whiz, you love the technology, you think it's interesting, but you find out that there's something going on underneath that is a little tricky and even dangerous. And unfortunately, in that case, really, really appalling, you know. Mm-hmm. So
if you take that concern, and the enthusiasm that we often have with the new toys, and you know, goodness, I can see part of your office and you probably see mine, we're surrounded by technology, and we are captivated by what this does. It gives strength through our arms. It allows you and me to talk to each other across different days. I mean, it's fabulous technology. But if you apply your concerns that you mentioned about OceanGate to the field that we're in, the application of digital technology to access to justice, where are your reservations?
Well, so there are a range of questions that are bubbling up, if I could say it like that.
Yep.
One of them is just with the kind of technology we're using right now, that you and I are on Zoom, okay, and this is a podcast, and apparently there is some technology, I think it's called Otter.ai or something like that, which will go ahead and transcribe everything that we do here. If one of us is a member of the Otter community, I don't know exactly how all that works, but one of the issues that's come up that has been raised, and I think well, by National Center for Technology and Dispute Resolution folks, Leah Wing and them, was, you know, when you're doing mediations or you're doing arbitrations that are ostensibly confidential, and do all people know that this Otter AI thing is actually making a transcript of what is going on? And then secondly, what exactly happens with that transcript once it's been done? I mean, it goes to some cloud place, I assume, somewhere. Well, what's the access to that? You know, it's a situation where you don't even get to opt in or opt out. It's just happening, and you need to be. It's the kind of thing where you'd like to have a possibility early on, or as the mediator, or as a neutral in controlling this space, trying to make sure that the space is operating in a way that is consistent with the confidentiality and encouraging the dialogue that you would want to have in it. So that's just a little one. A second type of issue is it's kind of like the incantational capacity for technology for us. I've heard people tell a great story about there was some faculty meeting or something where the faculty were sitting around, and one of the members of the faculty said, well, you know, 20% of the people in this area actually don't succeed at this kind of claim, right? And the other faculty members are like, 20%, I wonder why that's the number. You know, I would have thought the number had been higher. I thought the number, oh. They did not challenge the 20% number. They just went into a discussion about the number because of the incantatory power of just using a number, right? Well, there's kind of something like that with technology, because there have been some interesting situations where, again, as part of access to justice, court will have an option, voluntary option, to have the use of AI, some kind of algorithmic analysis being done at the time of sentencing with regards to giving a report about the likelihood of recidivism, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, something will be generated. Let's say if the recidivism scale is 1 to 10 and it says this person's a 7. Wow, well, that's a 7. That's a high risk person, and potentially, and therefore that might lead to maybe a harsher sentence, right? Well, no one really understands how the algorithm got to the 7, and the company that provides the technology is obviously protecting its intellectual property and is not allowing you to get in there to find out what it is. You know, it's sort of like they talk about black boxes versus white boxes versus gray boxes. Well, some of the experiences that were done where judges were given this option was that the judges who tended to take advantage of the options tended to give harsher sentences than the judges who didn't, right? And you know, it's like, is that because of the sort of the incantation of the technology? Well, let's take a look at the technology. How does the technology, how does the algorithm work? Where does it work? It goes and grabs from the information that's available, And if the information as available seems to dictate to a certain answer, well, then they come, you know, we're back to our old, that's been around for probably 70 years since the computer stuff started, with garbage in, garbage out. But it's all dressed up and put in a nice, neat package that it looks like something that seems really credible, right? When in fact, it may not be credible at all. So, I mean, that's a second type of concern that's there. I think there's a third level, which is, I think, more philosophical. It's something I read a while back that really struck me, which is that it's possible that back in the 50s, there was an error that was made in the way that people thought about the way the brain works. Right. In terms of thinking of the brain as working like a computer. So ergo, when we do the kind of thinking that computers, we do the kind of things that computers do, it's mimicking the brain, right? And that this was like a fundamental error at the time, and that it's kind of played out in the background of all these technologies. And in fact, the human brain does not work that way. The way I love to bring this up is that we've talked about AI all the time right now. AI. And I was at a conference where there was a distinguished Chinese scholar who was there in Montreal. And I said, isn't AI also the way in the Chinese characters that you say love? AI, isn't that the term for love? And she said, yes, that's the term for love. So I was like, everybody's talking about love when they talk about AI, right? You know, right. But that could a computer make that analogy that is coming from, you know, phonetically saying Chinese characters to talk about this topic of AI? Probably not, right? But why does this weird brain that I have do these kinds of things? Well, that's part of sort of the mystery of this sort of human nature. I have a colleague at Toledo who did maybe a fourth version of this, which is he would get mail. We call it junk mail in the United States for things that he had no interest in, right? And we talked about getting all this junk mail in our mailbox. And he said he loved getting junk mail. And I said, well, why do you love getting junk mail? He said, because when they send me things that I know I have no interest in, that means I have confused the algorithms. The algorithms thought that they knew who I was, but in fact, they don't, you know? And so when he's always excited to get junk mail, because it says they clearly don't know who I am, you know? And so I started to wear a t-shirt called Confuse the Algorithms, which is kind of like along with this technology idea and the rest of it, which is to sort of reclaim that human aspect of what we are, which we can only be, right? And then rather than think in terms of artificial intelligence, we should just think of human intelligence assisted by technology. That's really where I started to go to. So that it gives you that certain distance, if I could say it like that, from what's happening, to just say, wait a minute, this is not some magic that there. It's just a technology that may assist me, it may not assist me, but it's me. And by the way, in that technology, there's a lot of choices that humans have made that have made the technology come out the way it does. So that's part of keeping that balance between the gee whiz, isn't it great technology side of it, and the, well, wait a minute, to what extent is this technology? It's something I need to be not suspicious of, but at least skeptical about in a healthy way, so that I don't get sort of overtaken by it, you know?
In particular, there's a huge amount to unpack there, but and I guess we don't need to, but I'm just reminded when you were talking about the old analogy between computers and brains, you know, the computer is just a brain made of, you know, well, sorry, the brain is a computer made of meat, and that sort of commentary. remember years ago reading a comment by a neurophysiologist, I think in the UK, saying that if the brain were so simple that we could understand it, we would be so simple that we couldn't.
Perfect. Exactly. 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 Yeah. You know, and you know, and you know, some of the amazing flavor of things that happen. Some people talk about it as what synchronicity. Some things talk about other kinds of ways that thing happen that you that really are maybe will be seen as being even spiritual. That that seems to be kind of lost. I'll give you a story that happened to me last Thursday. There was I took my wife to the airport, and I got back in time to go to a movie at a theater that I kind of wanted to see, a comedy. So I went to see the movie, enjoyed it, and you know, waited around till the end of the movie, and then waited around through the credits just in case I had some of those little surprises they do at the end of those movies, right? And nothing went on, and then the lights came up, and then the usual background music starts up. And I said, wait a minute, that music is from this group called the Grateful Dead. That's a surprise. I usually never hear the Grateful Dead being the background music at a theater. So I went outside, talked to the attendant, said, hey, you've got the Grateful Dead as your background music. And he said, well, yes, because we're having what they call a meetup, which is to play a former concert of the Grateful Dead on a screen for people who like the Grateful Dead. And they were having a meetup that night. Now, it turns out that the Grateful Dead was one of my most favorite, you know, my favorite bands. And yeah. I said, so really, was this all about coming to the theater so that I would see the Grateful Dead meetup and not the first movie? Yet I had not seen any of that happening until it occurred, right? There's no logic in any of that. There's no affinity marketing. There's nothing going on. There's just a little bit of serendipity, you know, that I personally am a strong believer in serendipity, and because of the amazing paths that it leads to, you know.
And I guess the technology point you were making earlier is that you may be able to build a number of pathways into technology which will account for variations, but it won't do that for you. It won't do serendipity.
It won't do the serendipity. Yes, it won't. It may create pathways for interesting things, like as you remember back when we started out doing the international competitions, you know, it was text-based, right? It was text-based. And people were ridiculing text-based. But it occurred to me that, you know, how many times has it occurred in your life that somebody wrote you a letter back in the day? It's text-based. Mm-hmm. Yet it would move you so much that you would be crying, right? So, you know, the emotion would come through the text, right? Now, one of the funny things that happened in that was there was somebody from some school who was named Gabriella. And so some students from some other school around the world start to chat up Gabriella, so to speak, and find out that Gabriella was a man, was a woman. Yeah, no, yeah. Gabriella was a man because they were thinking it was a woman, right? So, you know, so the medium did not allow for us to actually, the people to see each other, right? But the possibilities that the technology provides. I mean, you and I would have never met in this world. I mean, the chances that you and I would run into each other at a conference were random, really, in that setting. There would have been little ways to connect. And then all of a sudden, we were kind of throwing out this idea and we were able to connect. And then from that, there's a possibility of dialogue. And then from that possibility of dialogue, you know, then the actual meeting in what we call meet space in the real world occurs. Mm-hmm. But really, a relationship gets built over time, you know, in the virtual space that is actually in a way very magical. Because I mean, you've sent me things along the way that have just really helped me to go, wow, let me think about that. That's another way of looking at it, you know? And so that part of the use of this technology, you know, I'm an enthusiast for. there's a thing you do in the United States under our common law system when you are a lawyer is you do a thing called shepherdizing. This company called Shepherds, where you would look up the citation for a case, and that book would indicate to you whether that case had been overruled or distinguished and all that. So that way you could find out whether the case you were citing was quote unquote good law or not, right? Yeah. And back in the, I'll call it the horse and buggy days, there were these little books that you got.
Yep. I remember books.
You know, and those little books had these pocket parts that came out every month. Mm-hmm. And you know, you had to go through this convoluted process. And I was not very good at it. I got out of law school in 1983. But I was writing an article, say, 30 years later, and I asked my students, you know, how they shepherdized, right? And they, you know, basically highlight the citation, stick it into Lexis or Westlaw, these kinds of technologies, and boom, out comes this thing with red flags, yellow flags, links to every possible case that had ever talked about it that they have in their system, great. And, you know, it was so much easier than what I'd been would have had to have done 30 or 40 years before. Right. And, you know, that's an example of technology enhancing. Problem is, this is what I love. I don't know if you saw this case where this lawyer filed a brief in a court and it turned out that ChatGPT had created a whole series of fictitious citations.
Yep.
You know, as I'm looking at it as a law professor, it says you are always supposed to shepherdize everything. Clearly this lawyer hadn't, you know, but the idea that, you know, it would look so authoritative, you know, on the surface, it would look really quite good. But, you know, technology again, there we go.
And it's kind of artificial authenticity, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, yes, that's kind of an oxymoron, artificial authenticity. That's perfect. It's exactly the kind of thing it is. Yes, yes.
I just think also when you talk about shepherdizing and Westlaw and Lexis and the ease with which our students, well, now I'm not in the teaching business anymore, but our students would be able to go to the electronic database to find ideally the correct answer. Here in our very own home, we actually see the human side of that, because one of the things my wife, who's also a lawyer, one of the things she does is commentaries on employment law. So there's a human being who's going through all the cases, working out which ones have been current, which ones have been overruled. So what the students see is the end product, what attorneys see as well as the end product of that work that goes on in the study downstairs in this very apartment. So there's still, that's the data entry point. I mean, that's one, she and many other people will be doing that kind of work, or doing the, one of the other things she does for the Law Society is headnoting, usually high court cases. So there's still always going to be points where somebody is entering the data.
Yes.
Unless you've got to the point of optical character recognition and automatic data, you know, reading of whatever the judgment is. But even then, somebody has written that judgment. Well, we hope that somebody's written that judgment and not handed over to ChatGPT.
Right. And you know, the process that she goes through in weighing the language that's used, you know, what is a leading opinion, right? As opposed to interesting, but not really a significant development or something like that. Mm-hmm. How, you know, that kind of weighing that comes from the experience of seeing, you know, that's human intelligence. I think that, you know, you can create numbers that say, well, how many times that has this case been cited, right? And therefore, the case has been cited a lot of times, therefore, it's an important case. Maybe not necessarily. It's like sort of a freebie, if I can say it like that. Everybody cites it, but it's actually maybe cited wrongly, whatever, you know, and all that nuance that's there that her human intelligence does in coming to her, trying her best, accurately show the head note, accurately show the development of the law in that area. You know, that's the thing that you worry will get lost, because it's like glibness. You know, it's like you meet people who are glib, and it's really amazing to watch them, right? I mean, they just, I'm not going to say anything that I hope will bother anybody, but like, you know, I met a number of what used to be Queen's Counsel, but who are King's Counsel in England, right? You know, and watching them talk was just, it was intoxicating. Their capacity, you know, to argue every different way of everything, right? You know, but whether it had content was another thing, you know, whether it had content, whether it, you know, really persuaded, is, you know, those are things that, I don't know how to say it, but, you know, it's almost intuitive in their power. I remember a story of one of the Supreme Court justices of the United States was sitting in on a House of Lords meeting in a case. And, you know, the Queen's Counsel at the time was going to talk about some statute. And what I loved was that one of the Lords said, well, if you're going to be talking about interpretation, I shall have to leave. No, Your Lordship. Then, you know, quickly, no, Your Lordship. That's what I was going to do. I was just going to point out, and then he goes into his interpretation, whole discussion, right? But that, you know, that humor, that you have to, if you're reading that on paper, and you're don't have that sense of what humor is, you would miss completely that the interaction, right? As a machine, you know, how do you trigger for humor? Or something like that in that kind of setting. But anyway, all I'm just trying to say is I'm an enthusiast for using technology and how it can help with doing a number of things with regards to dispute resolution, facilitating certain aspects of certainly access. At the same time, you know, it. I think personally that it may be obvious that, you know, there you have to have this view that it's just assisting human intelligence. Mm-hmm. That, you know, that if you get too taken up by these invocations of artificial intelligence and all that, in a way you're being sold a bill of goods that is dangerous. There's another thing I want to add on this, if I could.
Please.
There used to be a great deal of concern about the confidentiality of arbitral awards, making sure that, you know, arbitration was a dispute between the parties with the arbitrators, and the award gets rendered. Maybe you would hear about an award having been rendered when it would be attacked in a court, then therefore the award would be in the public domain, but otherwise it was not. Well, one of the things that I've watched that's been kind of interesting the last 20 years is there's a whole industry talking about what's going on in arbitrations. You know, I read the, you know, their various magazines, their past arbitral awards that are available that you can search. And, you know, and I think about, did the parties really want this kind of global access, maybe for a fee, on their arbitral awards? You can clean them up and all that. And back in the day, there used to be a thing where there would be extracts that would be done and all of that. But, you know, that's one of the things that I wonder about is to, particularly international commercial arbitration, is this sort of transparency as to the awards a healthy thing? Because the idea was it was sort of like cleaning your dirty clothes in private and getting it resolved, whatever the dispute was, and moving on. And now, you know, how an arbitrator decided in one case will be, you can search every case they've ever been in and see how they decided and try to predict how they're going to decide whatever the issue is in your case, all that kind of stuff. you know, I see the benefit that that can be, but that, you know, I've been, maybe I'm just an old fogey, but I just thought, well, confidentiality used to be a pretty important thing, you know. Now, there are other areas in the United States. We have labor arbitration, and that has generally been one where the opinions of the arbitrators are published. And that's been part of the ethos of that area of dispute resolution. So, but, you know, in international commercial, back in the late 90s, you know, the focus was on keeping things confidential. Maybe it was illusory. I don't know. But, you know, that was part of what it was. But that seems to have all gone away. With the technology, that seems to have all gone away. And there are, you know, consulting firms that will advise you on how to pick an arbitrator, all mm-hmm. kinds of things, you know, predict what your case is going to be worth, whether it's going to be successful or not, you know, for fee, right? You know, and, you know, although, you know, and I'm not saying that that wasn't done in the past, because, yeah, sure, somebody would go see their lawyer and their lawyer would look at the case and tell them this, that, or the other about it. But now, you know, it's like an industry developing of people who are kind of using technology and some kind of methodology of consulting to advise. And I, you know, I'm just maybe a little, my skepticism, it keeps coming up, in, you know, in those kinds of settings. I don't have the answer for it, but it's just something I watch, you know, as a current development.
Yeah. And I guess we're having been around the field for, well, not only the digital field, but around law for some time, it gives you that kind of vantage point of seeing what has changed. And, you know, and some of that change is for the better in terms of access, but we can't assume that all of it is. And it goes back to your original point about the technology. We can't assume that because this technology allows us to do clever things, it's automatically a public good or even a private good.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, when you think about all of these technologies at the back of them, you know, Zoom is a corporation, right? The one we're on right now. All of these technologies that we talk about are some kind of entity, maybe a startup, maybe, you know, part, you know, it's been bought by Microsoft, maybe they're venture capitalists that are in the background financing ChatGPT. I saw something about enormous amounts of investment money going into this ChatGPT and AI right now as the new thing, right? Well, everybody who's doing that is not doing it out of the goodness of their heart. You know, they're doing it because they want a return, which is totally normal, right? You know, totally normal. But then the question becomes of, you know, who will regulate this? Mm-hmm. How does it get regulated? I know a friend of mine, Daniel Rainey, is very strong on international standards being developed, like the ISO, International Standards Organization type standards for the technology for dispute resolution spaces, so that you could know if it's an ISO 9037 or whatever system, and that could, they could put that on the front, that would know that certain standards in terms of the dispute resolution mechanism put in place would be met. And in his argument is along the lines that it's better than trying to regulate it by law, because you've got, a, you know, 200 countries in the world that are going to have their own processes of determining law that will lead to variations from country to country, right? And, you know, and there are merits in both of those. My thing, you know, I had an opportunity to work with a lot of very senior international business type people over the years, right? And, you know, there were basically two things, you know, which was, you know, make more sales or reduce the costs. That was about the entire extent of the focus of somebody who's at the top level of one of these master of the universe type entities, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's, it, you know, when I, you know, the that does not capture the broader humanist vision of what's going on here, mm-hmm. that, I think really means that it starts to look like ethics issues discussed and are talked about are really just a part of a marketing campaign, you know, we're an ethical, you know, I'm sorry for being so, sounding so cynical. I'm not saying it like maybe the right way, but that, you know, that making that statement that, you know, we're doing this, that, or the other, and we're an ethical company and all that stuff, you know, it's like, it's true maybe up to a point, right? You know, it's true maybe up to a point. Like, all of a sudden you have workers who want to unionize, and all of a sudden they're using every trick that the old anti-union type folks have been doing for centuries to try to block workers from unionizing. You know, another kind of thing is that we will be a corporation that is compliant with the laws and regulations of a given country, right? Wherever they are. Well, you know, there are countries in the world that are, how should we describe it? A little authoritarian on the edges, maybe a lot authoritarian on the edges. Being compliant means what in terms of human rights in those particular settings? I know to speak about human rights is always something that people go, oh boy, what it is. But, you know, with all due respect to those who are skeptics on human rights, it's still an important thing. It's still an important thing. And when you're looking at entities that their focus is only on, for the most part, increasing sales or reducing costs, human rights are not high on that list.
Yeah, well, we need to only look at things like the condition of the fabric workers in Bangladesh and think, saying, well, if you want to be able to buy a T-shirt for $10, the only way of being able to do that is to have it made somewhere where somebody, typically a woman, is not going to get paid an awful lot. And your point about the corporations saying we will comply with laws means that they might choose a country which is not a member of the International Labour Organization.
Exactly.
Or doesn't have labor or environmental or other standards. So, which takes us off into much larger domain. I wish we had time for this further conversation too, because that touches on something that you have quite frequently raised in our other conversations, which is the absolute imperative to keep our ethical searchlight trained on this field. I mean, because we are dealing with technology, does not exempt us from dealing with or addressing the ethical issues which have been around since long before people invented pencils, let alone computers. And so that I think is one of the key contributions that your voice has brought to our conversations in this field.
Well, thank you. Once I got to the point of saying, no, this is human-assisted intellectual, human-assisted informational technology, you have this, I think each of us, in our own way, has this sense of sort of what is ethical. There's, you know, the classic issue is between what is ethical and what is legal, right? There are a lot of things that are totally legal that may not be ethical, right? And there are people who go right up to what is legal. There are people who go beyond what is legal and see if they can get away with it, right? That's another part of the game. If you look at the field of dispute resolution, right, and you think of the field of dispute resolution as having certain things it's trying to do, which is provide justice, fair process, and these are all words that are weighted with lots of different values that I understand. But words like neutrality, words like impartiality, words like independence, all of those are weighted words and they have cultural aspects to them that can vary. I mean, in some settings, for example, the view is the role of the arbitrator is not to render the arbitral award, but it's to get the parties to settle. It's like a peace thing that really is the role of the arbitration. A dispute has gotten to this point. Yep. We're going to help you get to a settlement. who's going to care about writing an award, right? And then in other cultural settings, it might be, no, we're going to basically in the adversarial saying, here's right, here's wrong, and things like that. Even methods, you know, the inquisitorial approach to trying to find the truth versus the adversarial is a classic discussion that you have all the time. But underlying it is this idea of a neutral process of some kind, and some independence and impartiality by the adjudicator or the mediator in that setting. And so these, you know, ethical requirements are inherent to the field. Maybe not every field, but it's certainly in this field. So to the extent that you're bringing in technologies that are potentially not taking that into account because of other priorities related to the technology, it's a real thing to have to worry about. I mean, it's just a thing that you have to take into account. And I don't know what the right answer is. I know that there are different efforts that are made to try to address it. For example, there's a thing that started here with regards to diversity in international arbitration or in arbitration. You know, there's some interesting issues that have arisen. For example, if somebody is a diabetic, right? A lawyer is a diabetic, they need to give themselves a shot at 5 p.m. roughly as part of taking care of it, right? Well, if you're the kind of arbitrator who wants to get everything done that day and wants to run till 7 or 8 or 9 at night to try to get it done so you can catch a plane the next day somewhere, are you really doing something that is fair in terms of that, I don't know, that disability that this particular lawyer has, that's just inherent to who he is or she is and their identity? That I think that could be a fairness issue that's there. Now, the dilemma is that, you know, in the pseudo macho world of being a tough lawyer and all that, are you allowed to be upfront with everyone about this thing? I'm terribly sorry, everybody. I'm a diabetic and it's at 5 o'clock, I'll have to take a shot. It's not a comment on anybody. You know, but does the culture of the type of environment you're in allow you to do that? You know, that's one thing. There's another type of issue that, you know, has gone on for a long time, and it has been the whole gender issue, right? The whole gender in this field. I mean, when I started working in international arbitration, you know, it was all guys.
Yep.
All guys. But the weird thing was that you would be, you know, if you went by somebody's law offices, you would have a number of women lawyers assisting the great man, you know? So they were not on the front scene, so to speak, but they were on, you know, in the back, right? I mean, there would be guys too, but in terms of the path, it was this kind of assistant to the great man role that these lawyers had. Well, you know, there was an effort made, and it's been going on since at least 1993, by women in the field to say, well, actually, no, we will, you know, we want to be front and center. We want to be the first chair. We want to be sitting as arbitrators and all. And, you know, I think in 2020 or so it was, you had Claudia Salomon, who was named the chair of the ICC's International Court of Arbitration, which is 97 years after it started, right? Well, that, you know, that whole process was a changing of a culture, right? A changing of what is expected. In fact, I understood that the chair before her made it a rule when they were renewing the members of the ICC's Court of Arbitration that there would be gender equality. So it's like leadership from the top saying, for all these national committees across the entire world, we want you to have gender equality with regards to your nominations of people to serve on the ICC court. Well, that's a revolution. I mean, compared to when I was back in the day, you know, where there was maybe one or two women on the ICC court, to today, we see this kind of range. In fact, you know, that's kind of a cultural change, right? That and how autonomous, how free those women feel in terms of how they are being in that space. What is considered to be advocacy? Is it only the advocacy of that, you know, that King's Council vision of advocacy that I remember 30 years ago, or Sir Michael Kerr, but God may rest his soul, kind of way of being? Or is it there other ways of being that are totally professional, that are totally acceptable, but that we culturally have had a hesitation towards for reasons tied to, you know, ancient history? I don't know. But, you know, these things, you know, these ongoing kinds of social developments. I spent a lot of time working on race as an African-American because, you know, I did a study back in 2004 where I was trying to find out what kinds of U.S. minorities were in international arbitration. And somebody said to me, I asked, you know, have you ever met an African-American in international arbitration? And they said, yeah, you. You know, I was like, me? I mean, you know what I mean? You know, I mean, it's like, really? You know, what? I'm such a weird guy. You know, apparently that was the only one. And, you know, and for me, it was like, well, this, all this stuff is so wonderful. This dispute resolution stuff, it's so wonderful in that, you know, others should take a look at this area, you know, if they hadn't been exposed to it before, right? You know, I mean, I'm sure you're, in your experience with students in New Zealand, you know, or in Singapore, you know, seeing the light go on in a student's
eye
about this as a path for themselves, that it, that they're not crazy, even though if they're first generation, or, you know, people, their families doesn't really understand what they're trying to do, but that your role in helping them to see, no, this is actually a thing you could be, right? Mm-hmm. That's magic, you know, that's magic. And then you see these people go on and do things far ahead of wherever you were, you know, it's just wonderful, isn't it? That's part of the
fun. That is the exciting part of it. And I mean, your point exactly too, where the students would come down when we were discussing mediation or working in conflict zones, they'd say, how can I get into this? How can I do this? And there's that sense of excitement and the sense of possibility for youngsters who might also not be entirely enthusiastic about the prospects of going to a Main Street law firm.
Yeah,
but they see other options, and that is what makes it exciting. But I'm aware also, Ben, that I've taken more of your time than I said I would, and I'm reluctant to let you go because I'm loving your extemporizing on this, and it's a, for me, it's kind of, if we're in a room, it's kind of fireside conversation, which I do enjoy about these podcasts. But I should let you go. It's your now early evening. And you've been extraordinarily generous with your time. So we should wind up now. I've got a feeling I'm going to need to come back to you on a couple of things and have another one of these chats, though, because there's things that I think we still need to talk about and I need to hear from
you,
particularly more on the equity issues. But we should wind down now and I'll let you go. So thank you for your time. I'll let you know when this is up and ready to run. So you have a good evening for in the rest of your day, and take care of yourself, my man.
Thank you, Ian, very much, and Godspeed to everyone.
This podcast has been brought to you by ICODER, the International Council for Online Dispute Resolution. To learn more about ICODER or to become a supporting member, please visit our website at icodr.org.